agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
Love the government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government.
Welcome to the Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Michael Baranowski, professor of political science at Northern Kentucky University. I'm joined today by my conservative counterpart, attorney and former deputy assistant to President Trump, May Mailman.
Hey, Mike.
Hey, May, how are you doing this morning?
I mean, now you wake up and it's dark outside.
Yeah.
Like, cold now. Like, we had a great past few days of fall, and that was lovely. But now I feel like the end is near.
Yeah, I totally understand. I like having the time in the morning a little bit to sort of do my own thing, but it's definitely too dark for me at this point, looking out my window recording this Saturday at 8 a.m. And I want more light, but we'll get some in a minute here, or at least in an hour or so, I expect. So, but we have a lot to get through today. But before we get to all the things we want to get to, including the new House Speaker, updates on Israel, Hamas, the agreement or tentative agreement between the auto workers and Ford, another plea in the Georgia election case and more. Before we get to all of that stuff, I want to thank a few new supporters, Owen and Carl, who both actually became annual supporters on Patreon. You can do that. You can do month to month, or you can do for an entire year. And if you do that, you save 10% over monthly support. So thank you so much, Owen and Cara. We really appreciate it. All right. So after 3 weeks without a speaker, House Republicans finally came together to elect Mike Johnson Speaker of the House. Now, Johnson's only been in the House since 2016, and he's never held a position in upper leadership or served as a committee chair in the House. But after the failed candidacies of a number of more well-known and experienced Republicans, the fact that Johnson was conservative enough to please the right wing of the caucus and, I guess, affable enough, as well as new enough, to have not made any serious enemies was enough to get him to the speakership. And this is a tough job, a big job, even under favorable conditions, Speaker of the House, because in addition to presiding over the House, the Speaker sets the legislative agenda. The Speaker has to spend a lot of time doing donor cultivation and fundraising. The Speaker's on a bunch of national security briefings because, of course, being second in line for the presidency, he's got a major communications role, pushing the party's views, legislative initiatives, that sort of thing. And the Speaker also manages House administration, and that includes security of the chamber. So that's a lot for anyone. Johnson definitely has a steep learning curve. And of course, as you would expect, the Democrats have responded, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, or the DCCC, they responded very quickly to the choice. They released messaging guidance in which they pointed to what they called Johnson's extreme record and wrote, "Speaker Johnson is nothing more than Jim Jordan in a sports coat," which I kind of like that one, actually. But anyway, May, what do you think about what's happened in the Republican caucus over the last, few weeks, but especially this last week, as well as the choice of Johnson as the new speaker?
The past 3 weeks have been embarrassing and frustrating to be a Republican, and I assume just an American generally. I know if you're a Democrat, maybe you're laughing that this is happening to the Republicans, but I think the low point for me was when it was an honest consideration that everyone was talking about whether to have Patrick McHenry serve as a limited, temporary, weak Speaker of the House. And for me, why did we kick out Kevin McCarthy, who is, you know, had all the full powers of a speaker, to get Kevin McCarthy just, you know, less powerful? The whole thing was so bizarre to me. But that makes me, I guess, very grateful for landing on one real Speaker of the House, not someone with limited authority, not someone with limited duration where we're just going to do this again, certainly in a month or however long. And then two, you know, yes, I do like that he is on the conservative side more than the moderate side. However, I don't think that that necessarily matters. Mike Johnson was not selected to fulfill some sort of policy mandate. He was selected because, one, I think he's a nice guy. He hadn't made any enemies. And two, maybe because he, you know, he wasn't going to push an agenda. Everyone felt comfortable that the committee process would play out, that, yes, you know, he's going to fulfill the roles of the speaker, but he's not going to shove things down people's throats. So I'm happy with where we landed. Was it worth it? No, for me, it wasn't worth it. But, you know, 3 weeks of chaos to end up with a Mike Johnson is for me acceptable, at least.
That makes sense to me. You know, I think that given the fact that he is so inexperienced, that probably means that Steve Scalise will have a bigger role as majority leader. And I think that that's maybe part of what was appealing about Johnson, is that the rank and file, at least a number of the rank and file, want a weak speaker. And also the fact that there's a good chance that Johnson isn't going to be speaker for long. I mean, who knows what's going to happen in the 2024 elections, but there's a reasonable chance that the Republicans won't be in charge of the chamber. And even if they still maintain control in January of 2025, that's not to say that they're not going to pick someone different for speaker. So I'm not saying he's necessarily a placeholder, but I think that that's a reasonable possibility.
Right. I think we were always headed toward a weak speaker just because we live in a country that is moving from like the 1950s of sort of monolithicness to more and more fractured views. And those fractured views you see within the Democratic Party, certainly about support for Israel. Those fractured views are in the Republican Party as well. So it's really hard to have a very fractured society and align people along really strong leadership that has really strong policy views. I think this has always been one of the benefits of Biden being so elderly, is that he is a little bit of a sock puppet. Like, he's not going to be too offensive to anyone because he is not a strong leader. He and that lack of strong leadership is sort of where what we get. The problem, of course, is that even though a person might not be a strong leader, the office is strong. And so in order to combat the amount of power that is accumulated in the presidency and the administrative state, you really do need a Congress that is able to combine together just to combat that power, not even anything on a policy matter, just, hey, you really can't be doing student loans. That is the job of the Congress. There are a lot of things to consider here. And if you don't have a powerful leader, and if you're not able to get a coalition together, then the presidency, even with a weak leader, I think, continues to grow and grow and grow. So I think that's a negative outcome, not of Mike Johnson necessarily, but just the nature, the almost like parliamentary nature of the Congress now.
Absolutely. I will agree with everything you said there, with one exception. I have a disagreement about how strong of a leader Joe Biden is, but that's another topic for another time. I looked into Mike Johnson and his record, and of course, I read probably more media from the left than the right, or the mainstream media, Washington Post, New York Times, that sort of thing. But I wanted to dig beneath that, because of course there's the, well, he voted to overturn the election. And let's actually talk about that, because there was a lot being made of a press conference right after he was named the new speaker, where a reporter asked him about his helping to lead efforts to overturn the 2020 election. It's interesting to me, when I think back to that time, I don't recall once hearing Mike Johnson's name mentioned in any reports, and now all of a sudden he's the ringleader of these things. And I find that sort of interesting how he sort of in retrospect, oh, wow, we didn't know how prominent he was. And that feels a little off to me. And I'll also point out that while maybe Virginia Fox shouldn't be telling reporters to shut up and booing them necessarily, I'll also say that if a reporter comes in with a question about overturning the election, when a conservative would say, well, I didn't think I was trying to overturn the election. I was taking measures to maybe help ensure the integrity of the election or something like that. I mean, it was a loaded term. And on the left, we call it election denying and overturning the election. But I think it's important to understand that to a lot of people on the right, it was about making sure that the votes were fairly counted, that the result reflected the will of the voters. And sure, there are some opportunists and horrible people who just will say whatever. But I think I feel that whole thing was maybe not blown out of proportion, but yeah, maybe blown out of proportion a little bit. Anyway, I want to get your take on that.
So, yeah, I have not studied every single thing that Mike Johnson has said over the course of 2020. And I do think the tenor of people's comments was radically shifted after January 6th, you know, you're part of a coup, basically, than before. But my understanding, looking at the amicus brief and the objections that were before the House, you know, preceding January 6th, is that there were a couple of states, and I'll pick, I think the only state where he voted not to certify the election was Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania, and I think Arizona and Pennsylvania were before the House. So it's not like I don't agree with the entire election and everybody is, you know, everyone's vote is tossed out. These are specific states about whether the processes in the states were trustworthy enough to go ahead and count those electors. And, you know, Pennsylvania was decided by a very small fraction of 1% of difference. There were other states that were closer, Georgia, but, you know, Pennsylvania was pretty close. And if you remember, there was a lot of COVID changes. And in Pennsylvania, one of the changes allowed for votes to be counted 3 days after the election. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court said, we're going to make you count votes received 3 days after the election. Even though Pennsylvania law says, no, you stop counting on election day. That was challenged all the way to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court didn't take it, but it did give people I think rightly, some concern that you're going to be counting how many votes? Is it hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of votes? You're counting votes that the state legislature said not to count. And of course, state legislatures, you can, you know, disagree with the strength of the independent state legislature theory. But clearly, Supreme Courts do have some limits on their ability to set election law. And I think that Mike Johnson's concerns were really that, is it fair, and this is a question to the Supreme Court, and this is an amicus brief that we're writing to the Supreme Court, is it fair for one state's Supreme Court to change the rules in such a manner that it affects a nationwide election? Are other people in other states, are they able to have a fair election in a process like that? And this is a case that the Supreme Court didn't take. And I think there were a lot of procedural problems, standing problems, you know, even just untested legal theories, maybe. But I think it is a reasonable question to ask. And so to just go and say, Mike Johnson is like a crazy nut election denier. He's out in Georgia trying to do like alternative slates of election, that type of thing, I think doesn't take into power these real untested questions about rules changing during COVID and whether the rest of America has to deal with Pennsylvania's, anti-legislative decisions.
Yeah, I agree with that. While I don't necessarily agree on the substance in general, I agree that Johnson is being at least on the left, is being we're being led to believe he might be something that he isn't necessarily. And for those reasons you mentioned, those legitimate reasons, but I'll also suggest Jay often talks about this idea of a free vote. And that if you know that a lot of people in your base are upset about something, rightly or wrongly, and you know that your vote supporting that, regardless of what it is not going to actually make this thing you might not actually agree with happen, well, you have, in essence, a free vote. And Jay's argued for a long time that many members of Congress who voted not to certify in certain states essentially knew that that wouldn't happen. So they could say, well, I voted against this to kind of keep the MAGA people happy, knowing that it wouldn't. And there could be an element of that as well. And again, so I think it's important to sort of keep that in perspective, as well as when I look at Mike Johnson's actual record. Heritage Action, for instance, a conservative advocacy group, gives Johnson an 84%, which sounds pretty good, but dozens of Republicans get 100% from Heritage Action. And if you look at VoteView, according to their ideological vote methodology, there are 58 Republicans in the House who are more conservative than Johnson. So that means that Johnson is actually, by this methodology, actually to the left of more than a quarter of House Republicans. So I'm not saying he's not conservative. He's certainly conservative. He's more conservative than Kevin McCarthy, but he's not some way out radical, at least on every issue. I mean, there are certain issues he's really strong on, absolutely, and I'm not crazy about that, but I feel he's being mischaracterized. And I guess one of the things that bothers me so much about our politics on both sides is that we take snippets of things that people have done, we take individual actions, and we do our best to put them in the absolute worst possible light and to create a narrative that somebody coming into a position, whatever it is going to be awful for all these reasons. Here's why they're an awful human being. And maybe Mike Johnson turns out to be a horrible, radical, far-right, nutball speaker. That could happen, sure. But I'm kind of interested in seeing what actually happens as opposed to just assuming he's going to be this horrible election-denying threat to democracy. And you know, let's wait and see what happens, I guess, is my take.
Yeah, and I testified before Mike Johnson a few months ago so my testimony is about Title IX and how it protects women. But the more sensitive topic of the hearing was about sex changes for minors. And, you know, it was a sensitive hearing. On one side, you had Chloe Cole, who did not have, I think, sufficient medical guardrails and was allowed to, quote unquote, transition. And it's irreversible. I mean, her body shape is different, her voice is different, and she deeply, deeply regrets it. She might not be able to have kids. So that to her is, you know, her life is radically altered. Very sensitive discussion. On the other side, you had a mother of a child who identifies as transgender, you know, who was having a really rough time. You know, they weren't sure whether he was going to commit suicide, that thing. And she felt as though having access to transgender procedures saved her child's life. Very sensitive hearing. And Mike Johnson, in the center of it, I thought did a great job. No one was yelling at the entire hearing. And this is like judiciary. So this is these are the rabble rousers. I mean, you had Matt Gaetz asking questions. You had, I think, Chip Roy asking questions. So on the other side of the aisle, Jerry Nadler. So these are people who are household names who want to be on TV. And I think he did a great job of making sure everyone had their voice heard, everyone could get their questions in, that points of order were addressed correctly, quickly, without escalation. And I would think that that's how he's going to act as a speaker, which is, no, he does not have a big comms shop built out. In fact, I was not, you know, that impressed with the comms operation there. But he's going to facilitate the working operations of the Congress. And I think that that's all you can ask at this point.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. Something else that's, I think, worth pointing out is that it seems like Mike Johnson knows how to move legislation. I look back in the last Congress, there were only five House Republicans who got more of their bills out of committee than Johnson did. And that, I think, is a positive. Not only that, but in the sort of battle for the speakership, if you will, Johnson actually released to his colleagues in the Republican caucus a pretty clear plan that involved extending the CR until January, or actually, I believe until April 15th of next year, and then kind of a step-by-step plan on how he wants the budget process to go. In fact, he said, I don't think we should take any summer break until all 12 budget bills have passed the House. So he's a guy, I think, who understands how things work and has a plan to make things work. So he's not, to me, some crazed rabble rouser who just wants to go in there and break. Like if Matt Gaetz had been named Speaker, not that that would ever happen, that would be alarms and red flags all over the place. But this guy is, you know, I don't think he's Jim Jordan in a sport coat. I think he's, you know, sort of far-ish right guy, but who I think has some understanding how the institution works and seems like a reasonable guy for the Republicans to pick for this job, even if it is for the short term. So I'm going to try to be cautiously optimistic about Mike Johnson, and we'll see. But the final thing I wanted to ask you about this is, relates to something that Matt Gaetz said. He said, if you don't think that moving from Kevin McCarthy to MAGA Mike Johnson shows the ascendance of this movement, the Freedom Caucus, and where the power in the Republican Party truly lies, then you're not paying attention. What do you think about that? Is Matt Gaetz right about that? And is that a good development, bad development, or what do you think?
I don't think he's right. And that's just not because I like to say that Matt Gaetz is wrong about everything. So I always said, and I went on TV and said, that the person who's going to rise out of this process is not going to be the most moderate candidate. He's not going to be the most conservative candidate. He's going to be the nicest candidate. And I think that's exactly what happened. I think this shows the ascendancy of niceness, that just putting your head down and doing the work will get you far with your colleagues. And so I've seen a lot of, I think, ill-informed, just tweeting from Matt Gaetz and a lot of the conservative commentators really celebrating this as a win for social conservatism or whatever. You're not going to have, like, did they change the Senate? I missed that. So yes, I think Mike Johnson, you know, is personally socially conservative and isn't shy about that. But I would not take that as an ascendancy of any group. After all, Jim Jordan, who was endorsed by President Trump, went down in flames, and it would have continued to get worse the longer that he stayed in there. So, no, I think that, you know, Mike Johnson kicked out Kevin McCarthy alongside Nancy Mace, one of the most moderate members of the Republicans. And so that just doesn't check out to me. And I will say that if it turns out that I'm wrong, and if it turns out that Mike Johnson rules as a wild social conservatism, you know, every conservative dream starts just getting airtime every second, the winners of that are not Republicans. The winners of that are Democrats, because I think that they're able to capitalize on portraying that as extremism. So, you know, like, let's just say I'm wrong and Mike Johnson really is sort of as quote unquote bad as he's being portrayed. That's a win for the left.
I think that's a really good point, because this works both ways, I believe. I think the Democratic Party, for instance, has lost support in certain quarters because the most progressive elements in the party, when they push too far, there's a rebound, a backlash effect. And the same thing we'd expect to happen on the right. So I know, I feel like in this entire segment, it's been me defending Mike Johnson. And I don't necessarily mean to. I mean, I would have voted for Hakeem Jeffries. I'd rather see him as speaker, certainly. But I think it's also important to not just jump into this assuming the absolute worst, though I'm certainly ready to admit the absolute worst if it happens. But we'll wait and see on that. Moving on last week's show, I suggested that it was reasonable to see Israel as a colonialist oppressor of Palestinians. And one of our listeners, Dave, been a listener for a long time, commented on Facebook and said, the term colonialist gets thrown around so regularly on the left as it criticizes Israel. I don't think people realize how anti-Semitic it is. And Dave's view of colonialism is, in his words, when a nation tries to rule and live in a place it has no connection to, like the British in India, and that, in my opinion, to refer to modern Israeli Jews as colonialists reflects a worldview that Jews do not belong anywhere, that their connection to that land is somehow illegitimate, like the British in India. And he ended his post by wondering if I stand by my use of the term colonialist. And I had to think about that for a little bit. And so I thought I'd start by looking at a definition. It's like, well, maybe I'm using the term incorrectly. And I went to the OED and they said colonialism is the principal policy or practice of acquiring full or partial political control over another country and occupying it with settlers. And it seems to me that under that sort of dictionary definition, that it wouldn't be unreasonable to suggest that Israel's being colonialist in regards to not so much Gaza, because they're not occupying it with settlers, but the West Bank and the other occupied territories. But I understand what Dave means is there's a difference in kind, and the British were sort of just culturally entirely out of their element. And so while I understand that difference, I guess I do sort of stand by my definition, but I wanted to get your take on that as well, May. Do you think, what do you think about what Dave had to say?
Yeah, I mean, to become an expert on Middle East territorial, I guess, yeah, history is something that I don't have an interest in becoming, frankly, but also that I'm not. But I think it's true. I mean, where did the Jews come from? Like, Moses left Egypt to settle in Judea in 1300 BC. This is, you know, almost 2000 years before, like, Islam is my understanding, even existed as an organized religion. So I do think that there is a territorial connection for the Jewish people, and I don't think that you can just forget that. I also think that looking so narrowly at Israel also is somewhat problematic, because if you zoom out and look at the region, it is Arab nation after Arab nation after Arab nation. I mean, just massive, like, surrounding of Arab nations, and then the tiniest sliver of Israel 9 miles wide. And so to say that there's some sort of, like, you know, colonist takeover here, I think requires a very myopic view of the Middle East in general. That said, I'm sure that someone could come in and tell me about all sorts of other history. That's, you know, happy to listen. For me, the problem, I guess, of immediately talking about colonialism after a brutal massacre is that it really undervalues that this was the largest murder, massacre, slaughter of Jews since the Holocaust. And instead of taking a moment and letting that soak in, we've immediately switched to pointing fingers and calling Jews names. That to me is the bigger problem. But yeah, I am definitely bought in to the notion that you should take a pause before calling someone a colonizer when they got there first.
I think, yeah, I definitely think that there's the issue is, as you sort of illustrate, is far more complicated than this kind of black and white. Are they colonizers? Are they not? And is this the time to focus on that particular larger issue? The other part of it, Dave sort of suggested that that's an anti-Semitic remark. I don't believe it's anti-Semitic on its face. You know, you can certainly be an anti-Semite and call Israel a colonialist oppressor, but it for that to be anti-Semitic, I mean, anti-Semitism means to be against Jewish people because they're Jewish people. You can be against the policies of Israel because you believe they're wrong, and you're not necessarily an anti-Semite. Just like you can be against the policies of, say, the Biden administration and not be anti-American. So I think it's we can conflate those things, and I don't necessarily. And again, I think so much of the thinking on this is oftentimes so unnuanced and so black and white because people are just dug into their corners. And there were certainly extremists on both sides who try to encourage that sort of thing. And Hamas would certainly be obviously the prime example of that sort of thing on the Palestinians.
But, yeah, and I don't like jumping to calling people anti-Semitic, but I think the reason that that's a fair charge is because if you look, I think, at the history, you know, well, what existed before Israel? Was that a Palestinian state? No, that was the British Mandate. Okay, well, what about before the British Mandate? Well, then that was the Ottoman Empire. Well, you know, what about before then? Also not a Palestinian. Like, there has never been an empire of the Palestinian state. There were, you know, Christian kingdoms, there were Egyptian, there was the Byzantine Empire, Roman Empire. But to quickly jump to river to the sea or that the Jewish people somehow don't deserve to be there, I think requires a level of blinders that we don't have for other regions. It just seems almost unique to Israel. And if it's unique to Israel, well, what's the other thing that's unique to Israel? It's that there's, you know, it's a Jewish state. And so I don't think that calling names is a useful strategy to getting people on your side. That said, I think that it's worth asking, you know, why is it that it's more difficult to look into the history here than it is in other places? Is it just too complicated? Like, I don't understand. So maybe it's not anti-Semitism, but it's something. And I want to know what that something is.
I think that's a really good point, because I don't think in many cases, or in some cases, certainly it's not anti-Semitism. But you're right, it is something. And it's a unique situation where in 1948, you get this state created out of whole cloth, and that just was bound to create all sorts of problems. But moving kind of from this sort of theoretical historical thing to more, I guess, of the moment type issues, on Friday, actually, the UN General Assembly overwhelmingly, I can say that word, passed a resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. The release of all civilians, the protections of civilians in international institutions, and safe passage of humanitarian aid into the Strip. And this comes as Israel seems to be starting its ground invasion into Gaza. Now, 120 countries voted for the resolution, 45 abstained, and 14 opposed the measure. And the 14 opposed were, as you would expect, Israel and the United States. And in addition, Austria, Croatia, Czechia, Fiji, Guatemala, Hungary, Marshall Islands, Micronesia, Nauru, Papua New Guinea, Paraguay, and Tonga. So not exactly a massive outpouring of opposition, but there were some notable abstainers, including Australia, Canada, Denmark, Germany, India, Italy, Japan, Poland, Sweden, and the UK. In addition to that, last week, the U.S. vetoed a UN Security Council resolution that called for humanitarian pauses on the grounds that that resolution didn't include an affirmation of Israel's right to defend itself. And U.S. also introduced its own Security Council resolution, which called for a humanitarian pause but also, in the words of the resolution, reaffirmed the inherent right of all states to individual and collective self-defense, but that in responding to attacks, all states must fully comply with all their obligations under international law, in particular, international human rights law, international refugee law, and international humanitarian law, as well as condemning depraved acts of destruction carried out by Hamas, including the use of civilians as human shields. And so that resolution was vetoed by, I believe it was Russia and China, because there are these five permanent members of the Security Council who have veto power. That's the U.S., Russia, China, the U.K., and France. So we had these dueling resolutions. We had this U.N. General Assembly resolution. Well, what's your take on this resolution stuff going on at the U.N. and how it matters or doesn't, and the position that the U.S. took?
It's embarrassing. So the United Nations was created after World War II in the wake of the Holocaust. So while not specifically to protect Jewish people, certainly with that in mind, that there's, you know, that we can't have this happen again. And here we have, again, the largest murder of Jewish people since the Holocaust. And the UN decides to criticize Israel, and they have historically criticized Israel more than the Chinese Communist Party, Russia, Venezuela, Cuba, Iran, North Korea, all of these other human rights abusers combined. So I don't know what its mission is. What is the mission of the UN? The US position, I guess, of saying that Israel can defend itself, but let's take a pause. I mean, every second that Israel pauses, for me, is going to be a bloodier conflict because hostages are being moved, you know, continually. Maybe hostages are no longer with us after then. They're able to hide themselves behind civilians. Like, what is the pause achieving exactly? If it's don't retaliate, then you're just going to ultimately have more Jewish people killed because Hamas is going to strike again. What is the point of the pause? I don't understand. If it's to move out civilians, Israel has already said that the civilians need to move from these places, but they're not being allowed to by Hamas. Well, I don't know. I don't understand the point of.
I don't know if it's quite as. I think there are more complexities to it. I would argue, and I think part of the resolution had to do with, in fact, the issue of human shields and releasing hostages, and I think that would have to be part of any ceasefire agreement. And so I would certainly be opposed to any ceasefire agreement that did not include the use of hostages, which is why I think the U.S. resolution, to me, seemed entirely reasonable, and that the veto of it by Russia and China is basically a larger geopolitical kind of thing. And not that resolution does anything in and of itself, because it's not like, oh, well, there's a resolution, we'll stop. I mean, it's up to the parties involved in this sort of thing. And so I certainly believe that Israel has a right to defend itself. And but I also think that doesn't mean that there's a line between defending yourself and going in and leveling entire neighborhoods, saying, well, they're in there somewhere, and we're just going to go ahead and pull through. And so I think there are arguments on both sides. And I think the danger is in responding out of understandable grief and rage and anger at the horrific things that Hamas has done, that you end up overreacting. And that, I think, is also a danger. And you know, I think that certainly in the aftermath of the horrific, inhumane stuff that Hamas did, that's not the time to say, well, you know, let's talk about colonialism. But I also think it's a time to say, well, let's make sure you react and you go in there, but you make sure you do it proportionately. And I think that's very difficult for Israel to manage. And I don't envy them. I mean, I feel like they're almost in a no-win situation. And that, I think, is exactly what Hamas was hoping to have engineered. And so far, I think they're getting what they wanted.
Yeah, when I think about, you know, the human rights abuses that the UN could be calling out and the level of scrutiny to Israel, those to me don't seem to align. They don't seem to be proportional. And it just makes me question all of the decisions coming out of this body. It also makes me question whether the United States really has a voice there, whether our votes necessarily do anything or matter. I mean, when I was in the White House, I feel like we spent all of our time at the United Nations editing documents for abortion language. I mean, it was just such a stupid, waste of time. We'll see what sort of value add the UN has here. But if their charge is to prevent wars, basically, and protect human life, then you would think that the elimination of Hamas would be a good strategy in preventing wars and preserving human life. And yet it doesn't seem to be even on the table. So that to me is concerning.
Yeah, and I understand that concern. But I also feel, and I guess I want to get your take on this, is it's if, for instance, I mean, there's a scale that on one end, you could say if it were possible to eliminate Hamas in sort of very targeted assassinations and just kill all of their leadership and without any civilian or collateral damage, I would be okay with that, obviously. But if it's on the other end, if you say, well, we can eliminate Hamas, but we're going to have to kill, 100,000 Palestinians to do so, who don't really have any direct involvement, I would not be okay with that. And I think you see what I'm saying, right? There's a point at which you have to consider weighing the collateral damage against the military objective, right? I mean, you would agree with that, right? Or maybe you wouldn't. I don't know.
I definitely agree with that. But my question would be, why do we never look at this in the lens of how many Jews have to die?
Sure.
Right? Oh, yeah. It's always... So, you know, Hamas left unchecked has showed us that they will march into Iran, receive military training, and then go and rape women and kill babies. Okay? So that's what they've shown us that they're going to do. Israel has shown that they're going to try and build a dome so that they're not retaliating every time that there's rockets and that they're just going to have to live with bomb shelters in their communities. Like, let's think about the life lost by letting terrorism and anti-Semitism run unchecked. And then let's have that conversation. And I guess I just feel that the UN too often puts one part of the equation, you know, okay, well, how many Palestinian lives, without thinking about, but, you know, every couple months, you know, Israelis have to go bunker down because they're getting bombed. That to me, it doesn't seem to be a fair conversation.
Sure. I think that there are some reasonable points to bring. You know, also kind of making this moving even more domestically, to point out that this week there were a number of Republican senators who introduced a proposal for aid to Israel as a standalone measure. And folks might recall that last week, I believe it was, the Biden administration put forward a $106 billion emergency funding bill that would include $14 billion for Israel, $61 billion for Ukraine, as well as $14 billion for immigration and border security. Now, there's a Senate bill that was introduced called the Israel Supplemental Appropriations Act of 2023. It would also call for around $14 billion of U.S. aid to Israel, so similar to the Biden administration's request, though it would not include any of that other stuff. And the reasoning of the Republican senators here is that given Republican opposition to Ukraine funding in the House, they're thinking that a standalone measure would make it more likely that aid could quickly be approved and delivered to Israel. Roger Marshall, senator from Kansas, said, my colleagues and I firmly believe that any aid to Israel should not be used as leverage to send tens of billions of dollars to Ukraine. And this is sort of from the right flank of the Republican Party in the Senate. The seven co-sponsors, J.D. Vance, Mike Lee, Ted Cruz, Marsha Blackburn, a few others, Tommy Tuberville. So I don't know that this really has any chance of going anywhere, but I wanted to talk about it because I think there's a larger conversation to be had about whether or not it makes sense to do these things as standalones or to link them together. And I wanted to get your take on that, Mick.
Well, I think it's completely sensible to de-link them. You know, the initial package proposed by the Biden administration was $61 billion for Ukraine and only $14 billion for Israel. Are those numbers, is that the right equation? I don't know, but why are they together? If you agree with the $61 billion, but you don't agree with the $14 billion, are you voting yes or no on this? If you agree with the $14 billion, but not the $61 billion, are you voting yes or no? I think that we have different strategic interests. We have different goals. There's different accountability. There's different trust levels. You know, these are different countries, and we should separate out the funding. I think one of the big problems is that there are a lot of Republicans who are peace through strength kind of people. We agree with military funding. We agree with a strong United States presence globally. That said, where has the money gone? We've spent a lot of money. We need an accounting. And if we spend more money, what's it for? What can we expect the goals to be? How will we know whether we have achieved those goals? What's our long range spending here? What will that change? Like, how will our money be positive or negative or neutral? You know, those are the questions, I think, with Ukraine, which is not necessarily should we help them, which I think you'll get a lot of Republicans to say yes, but what help is needed and how can that help be useful? Because if we're basically at a standstill right now and money is not going to, you know, get back the territory, a lack of money is not going to let Russia go. If it's just useless, then no, I don't want to spend the money. But if you can show me what the goals are, then yes. And I think it's a little bit easier for Israel to have that accounting, understand what the United States' interest is, understand what it means to meet your goals are. And because you have really, I think, disparate accountability for that money, they should be considered separately.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that because I was, as you were responding, I was thinking, well, would you say that the same standards should apply to Israel as well as Ukraine? And you answered that. Yeah, they should. And your thinking, as I understand it, is that it's easier to show all of those things in the case of Israel. But I'm wondering if it is, because it seems like, at least to this point, it's just been, okay, so, well, let's give them money and give them aid in response to this. And certainly, I think that's an easy thing to say yes to when we're talking about humanitarian aid. But when it comes to military aid, I think you can make a case that there are a lot of questions that we don't have answers to, at least not as far as I'm aware of, as to what the aid would be going to. Now, some of it would be the missile defense system, the Iron Dome system, and I can't understand how anyone would be against that because that's purely defensive in nature. But I think it's reasonable to raise questions about, well, will this money make it easier for Israel to launch and to increase and sustain a ground offensive into Gaza? And if so, well, what are Israel's goals there? And do we want to support those goals? And how much leverage do we try to exert over those goals? I mean, those are the same sort of questions that we would ask in the context of Ukraine. And so I would think we should also be asking those questions in the context of Israel, right?
I agree with that. I do think that we have a more long-standing accountability relationship with Israel because we do currently fund them so much annually, that we have the system set up. We know what your stockpile is. We know where it is. We know when it's being spent. We know how it's being used. Like that relationship, that accounting system has already been and is longstanding with Israel. With Ukraine, there are a lot of questions about, you know, people personally enriching themselves, which you've heard a lot about. We spent $120 billion. And to my knowledge, the House has asked the Biden administration multiple times for an accounting of how that money, you know, where it is, where, like, just give us some detail about how it's been spent, and hasn't received that information from the administration. So, question, maybe the administration has it and hasn't shared it. Maybe the administration doesn't have it because Ukraine is historically very corrupt and has absolutely no accounting of how the dollars have been spent. But either way, we don't have that trust relationship with Ukraine. And I think it's fair to say, well, we've already spent, you know, $120 billion. I would like an accounting of that before I send more. I think that's a fairer question than with Israel, which is we have decades of understanding of where things are. You do not have the same corruption problems that Ukraine has. And so it's not like it's a free pass, but there are fewer questions to be answered in advance, I would think, than with Ukraine.
I agree in principle on all of those things. I certainly, there's no question that Ukraine has a much greater history and track record of corruption, and we don't have nearly a relationship with Ukraine. And so for all, and not only that, but it's a much bigger conflict that we spent a lot more money on than anything I would say conceivably that we would be doing in aid of Israel. So for all those reasons, I agree. I think that there has been some accounting of Ukraine money spent, but not as much as certainly I would like. And the wastage, is something to use the term, to corruption is almost certainly going to be considerably greater in Ukraine than it is in Israel. And that's an important consideration as well. So for all those reasons, I would agree in general on that. Kind of pulling back a little bit as we move away from this story. How do you see this playing out? Because I talked last week, I argued that this seems to me to be kind of going along to the Hamas playbook, if you will. And Hamas wanted to put Israel in a no-win situation. And it seems like they pretty much have put Israel into a no-win situation. They wanted to disrupt the status quo in the Middle East. They wanted to shake up some of these potential alliances like Saudi Arabia, and Israel, not so much alliances, but sort of detente, if you will. And so far, it seems to me that they've achieved what they've wanted to achieve. And maybe it was easier for them given their position, but it's hard for me to see this not getting considerably worse before it gets better. Because already we've seen as the ground offensive has started, the media reports coming in, and we're going to see in the international media all this about, you know, collateral damage in civilians and women and children being, you know, harmed and that sort of thing. And it's hard for me to see Israel finding a good, clear, clean path out of this at any time soon. I want to get your take on that.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, when I asked some of my acquaintances who served at very high levels in the military, how did the United States and Israel miss this invasion? I mean, this was planned for ages. How did you miss this? I mean, they're retired, but and they had a conspiracy theory, which is I don't think that they did miss it. I think that they saw this as an opportunity of a final ability to take out Hamas, you know, like, and then of course the attack was way worse than anyone could have expected type of thing. You know, that's a conspiracy theory. I don't know how much, but you would have thought that after the images, after all the facts are coming out, just how horrific this attack was, that this really was the opportunity for Israel to say, we have tried. We have really tried. We have given control of Gaza to the residents there. We've evacuated all the Jewish people. We have let them elect Hamas as their sort of representative. We have facilitated aid. We have participated in all sorts of discussions with the U.S., with other Arab nations. We have tried. We have done everything. We've put up a dome system so that we can do our best not to care when they're blowing rockets at us. We've done everything. And then they came and did this. Let us go in and let us take out Hamas. And you would have thought that that would have been a very simple, easy, basic argument, and it's not. So I don't know. I don't know where I see this playing out, because if this doesn't give the world some sense of moral agreement that we have to find a solution that's different than just why can't we all get along? And we really do need to take out Hamas. If that didn't show you, then I don't see this ending well for Israel at all.
Yeah, I certainly would hope that almost everyone can agree, regardless of what they feel about the Israel-Palestinian situation, that it's not a good idea to have a corrupt, horrific terrorist organization in charge of a territory. I think that's pretty straightforward. It's simple. We should be able to be bipartisan on that. But, you know, the more I talk and think about this situation and read about it, the more just despair I feel filled with, because I don't see any good ways out. But maybe shaking up the status quo does lead to something better in the long term, though certainly the cost in the short term has been just awful in terms of lives lost, in terms of a refugee situation. And it's just very depressing for sure. Well, But on that depressing note, we're going to close this episode. And I'd just like to ask folks, if you're not already a supporter of the Politics Guys, we hope you'll consider becoming one, because without your support, this podcast would not be possible. And if you're a supporter, you get a number of benefits, ad-free episodes, the full-length version of our midweek show, which May and I are going to be recording in just a minute here, access to our Politics Guys Discord group where you can interact with us and other listeners, and even the opportunity to listen in and comment as we record the show each week. If you want to find out more about that, go to patreon.com/politicsguys. If you'd like to support us on Venmo, you can do that too. We're at Politics Guys, or you can also do that through PayPal. And all of our support links are in the show notes, as well as at politicsguys.com/support. And if you'd like to get that full-length midweek show, but you're not in a position to financially support the podcast right now, send me an email. I'm at mike@politicsguys.com, and I will make that happen for you. And whether you're a supporter or not, we would really appreciate it if you could subscribe, rate and review us on whatever podcast app you're listening on, and share episodes on social media. And if you want to get in touch with us for any reason, there are a bunch of ways to do that. There's email, mail@politicsguys.com. There's our Discord channel, which all of our supporters have access to, as well as Facebook and X. And you'll find links to them in the show notes. And finally, as always, a very special thanks to our fantastic executive producers, Bruce Johnson, Wilma Moreno, Andra Masker, Daniel Toe, Ryan Beasley, and Don Oglesby. We'll be back with a new episode for you next week. We hope you'll join us.